WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm pleased and honored to be able to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show speaking with journalist David Terechuk, who has covered a myriad of fascinating and important stories from all over the globe. However, his most recent book is a very personal book, a deeply personal book, in fact, titled A Question of Paternity, My Life as an Unaffiliated Reporter. Central to this really intriguing memoir is a mystery that has surrounded his own life, and that is, who was his father? For many, many years, David Terechuk's mother refused to divulge that information. Eventually, she did state to her son who his father was, which set him off on a ultimately frustrating, even infuriating journey to try to identify exactly who this man was. It raised more questions than answers. And the story of this long, difficult search for answers is the heart and soul of this really touching memoir. You have almost certainly consumed some of the journalism of David Terechuk, who has worked for a myriad of different organizations and outlets. He has done work for ABC, CBS, CNN, A&E, the History Channel. He has written for The Guardian and for The New York Times. He has been a correspondent for PBS. And broadcasts a weekly public radio dispatch of media criticism, which is called The Media Beat, and also has an online column of that very same name. Once again, this book is titled A Question of Paternity, My Life as an Unaffiliated Reporter. And David Terechuk, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's very good of you to have me on your show.
I'm excited to talk with you, and the book is absolutely fascinating and so deeply moving. Can you tell us just a little bit about what it felt like and continues to feel like to step out of your more customary role as a journalist, maybe an investigative reporter, to be delving into such a deeply personal story, and moreover, to be sharing it with the world?
Well, you get off to a good, interesting start, Greg, because that's the heart of my dilemma about ever having written the book. There's a deep paradox, I think, in my life, which prompted me to go on the search that resulted in the book, and indeed lies at the heart of the writing of the book itself. As you alluded to earlier, my job is essentially amounted to going around the world and asking people questions and getting answers, often reluctant people to be asked questions of, people who want to keep secrets, perhaps, and I'm thinking of people in power in particular, the presidents and movement leaders that I interviewed. And I would ask questions, and as I say, I would get answers for the public record. But in my private life, my personal life, there was this one big question that I did not have an answer to. And that paradox, all that irony, deep irony in a way, very discomforting irony, was what prompted me to go on the search and write the book about the search.
Mm. Let's find out a little bit about your background, your childhood in Scotland, and what that childhood was like. And in particular, through your childhood, how much the question of the identity of your father loomed over that childhood.
Well, I grew up in, not strictly speaking, Scotland. I grew up in what's called by historians the Debatable Land. It's that area on both sides of the border that the English and the Scots did more than debate about. They fought about over centuries. And our little town or large village was about 3 miles from where the border has now settled. I was actually on the English side, but all my mother's family had come from the Scottish side. We lived in public housing. We was a poor family. My grandmother she presided over the house. She was a widow, lost her husband about 8 years before I was born. And my mother was only 15 when I was conceived, and 16 when I was born. And as well as the poverty, there was this other cloud over us, which was the terms and conditions, can I put it that way, that my grandmother imposed about my coming into the household. It was a source of great scandal, great shame that I was conceived. And then born. My mother was sent away almost 200 miles deeper into England for me to be born. And I was allowed back under basically two terms and conditions I should limit it to, I think. One was that my mother should stop her high school education. She was more advanced in her education than most people of her generation in our family had been. She was evidently a good student and may possibly even have ended up being the first member of our family who went to college, but that wasn't to be. The new term and condition was that she should stop her high school education and go out to work, become our family's only breadwinner. My grandmother felt apparently that I was just one more mouth to feed, that she couldn't, that the household budget could not reach and encompass. So my mother became a wage earner, and I saw little of her, really. And the other term and condition, which is rather hard to credit now as I look back on it, but this is what they thought they could get away with. They wanted to pass me off as my grandmother's last child. She'd already had 10 children, 9 of which survived, 1 died of birth. And also, she was well past childbearing age. And, of course, my grandfather was no longer on the scene. And I, as I say, I don't know how they thought that story would hold up, but they did try and maintain it for a while. For how long, I don't know. It left me in a peculiar position. I called my mother Hilda, her first name, as if she was my older sister, which, you know, the fiction was that's who she was. And I called my mother. Here we go. There's the confusion already setting in. I called my grandmother Mam, which is the Scottish diminutive for, you know, the equivalent of Mom in the States. And there were two little boys in the household, too, my mother's little brothers. And they seemed like, they were certainly playmates for me, and they seemed like brothers, though in fact technically they were my uncles. So this uncertainty, I think, had its effect on me. I was uncertain about whose I was, and therefore uncertain about who I was. I don't know at what point it became clear to me. Nobody ever told me anything. This was a subject that was never spoken about out loud. But I think I came to divine that I was indeed my mother's child and not my grandmother's child. But when that happened, I can't really say. So maybe at 6 or 7 or 8, somewhere around there.
Can you say a little more about the relationship that you had with your mother, Hilda, during your childhood? I mean, when she was, for all intents and purposes, passed off as being your older sister, when in fact she was your mother. I mean, did the relationship itself feel like that between two siblings?
It's hard to say, Greg, honestly. But my memories are that we had a friendly relationship, a friendly and kindly relationship on my mother's part. She was kind to me. There's no doubt about that. I didn't suffer any ill treatment in my growing up. Just as I say, this gnawing sense of uncertainty. I have some lovely little pictures in my mind of the few times that I saw her in the daylight, because, as I say, she went out of work, so I didn't see much of her in the daytime. One picture comes to mind immediately of her rushing to get the bus into the city where she had a job. And it was, the bus, I think, was about 7:30, and she always seemed to be in a hurry, but she took time to sit with me, and our breakfast tended to be that of scrambled egg on toast. There were lots of eggs to be had. We may have been poor, but there were lots of chickens. Scrambled egg on toast was cut into tiny little, less than an inch square pieces, and she would feed me a couple of those, watch me carefully chew them before I swallow, and then rush off to work. So I think there was a special attentiveness that my mother gave me within the circumstances in which she had to operate.
Hmm. We're speaking with David Terechuk about his book, A Question of Paternity. It was really decades before you began to want to pursue the matter of who your father exactly was. Ahead of that, first of all, what did that question mean to you? Was it a question that you had simply shut away as irrelevant or unimportant? Or was it a question that on some level you knew was important and yet were scared of pursuing or addressing? How would you characterize for most of your life before kind of the shift in attitude, what was your feeling about this question of your own identity and more specifically the identity of your father?
I think it's perfectly possible that both your suggestions were operative at the same time, Greg. Hmm. I certainly internalized this notion that it was a topic that I should go nowhere near. I don't remember ever being told out loud that this was something I shouldn't approach, but I didn't approach it, and I suspect that I did internalize that code of silence that was informally and unspokenly imposed. And as I grew up, as I got into my teens and became more independent-minded, actually rather rebellious, in fact, I think what I was telling myself was that it didn't matter. Who cares? I'm my own independent individual. I was a burgeoning young man on the edge of his own life, and I was making my own way. And it was of absolutely no importance to me who my father might have been. I mean, as a kid, I think I fantasized about, maybe he was a passing aristocrat who'd come through our village and somehow in some fairy tale romance had fathered me in one sense only with my mother. But most of the time, certainly as I became, reasonably mature in my thinking, and I was able to make my own independent decisions about how to handle this matter anymore. I wasn't under the thumb of my grandmother or my mother. I just dismissed it as irrelevant to my very independent professionally based. Because that's what I thought the most important thing in my life was my job. And that's really all I thought about. And it didn't really matter to me who
sure.
my father was.
Well, you had an interesting job and a challenging job and very fulfilling work. So I can understand how that would very easily take center stage in terms of your focus and energy and so on. Then something changes when you were in your 40s. Can you put your finger on exactly what changed? I mean, what was the nature of the hunger that you seemed to feel in terms of wanting to get this question answered? And was it a sudden realization that this was in fact important for you to know, or would it be more correct to characterize it as a gradual awakening of interest in this matter?
Well, there was a degree of suddenness to it, because there was a radical change in my life going on at that point anyway. It's important to say that one of my ways of dealing with all this uncertainty was I had large recourse to alcohol. I became an alcoholic, in fact, through 27 years of my life. And that was another way of sort of clouding out the issue and making it seem unimportant to me. If I'm honest about it, I think I was probably escaping the question. And then because alcohol had obviously become such a huge problem for me, I came to the decision that I was powerless over it and I had to stop ingesting it. It was as simple as that. I say simple, and simple to say, hard to do, but with a lot of help, as alcoholics often do need help, I ended up sober. I also ended up marrying a wonderful woman who, that marriage involved me moving from my home country of the UK to the United States. And we set up a new married life. And one of my purposes, I think one of my inevitable results of being sober now was that I didn't want any longer to evade things. Getting sober involves, as you probably know and have heard this from other alcoholics, that it's really important to look at one's life square on instead of trying to avoid the difficult parts by diving into a bottle or a glass. And that's what happened with me. I wanted the clarity that I was so grateful to have in my life now to extend throughout my life. And I didn't want to have this horrible cloud between myself and my mother. That's how I saw it. I saw it as something that clouded what could be a much more open and direct relationship. We'd sort of drifted apart. I didn't have much contact with her, certainly not when I was in the United States. And I wanted to get to the bottom of the mystery, you know, to dismiss the secrecy from my life. That was my mission. And that's when I started talking to her seriously about whether she could please tell me who my father was.
We're speaking with David Terechuk about his memoir, A Question of Paternity, My Life as an Unaffiliated Reporter. So again, so our listeners understand, for decades, this question had, in a sense, lain dormant, at least as far as your mother was concerned. And then when you were in your 40s, as you were just now explaining, you came to realize that this was something that you really wanted to know, and ultimately then approached your mother about. That is, you posed this question very directly to her, who was or is my father? Can you just characterize for us what it felt like? That is what I should think was a momentous experience of raising such an important question after all of this time. And I'm curious what that moment felt like, posing a question like that to your mother, you who had probably posed questions to military officers and maybe prime ministers and other officials and so on, but I mean, to be doing so under such different circumstances.
You're hinting at the fact, I think, Greg, that it was not the same as interviewing a president or prime minister or military commander. It was not. It was very difficult. Not that the presidents and military leaders were easy either, but this was of a different order, talking to my mother. I had to screw up my courage to the hilt, as Shakespeare once called it, I think. It felt like picking up a sword almost and going into battle. And, you know, initially I got nowhere. You can't necessarily, this is one of my conclusions about my whole search, is that you can't really treat your mother like any other interview subject, that I might, you know, I might take certain techniques and apply them to her in the same way that I would to a devious politician, say. And for a while, I got nowhere, frankly. She was very evasive and wouldn't answer the question, and avoided communication with me, too, for some time. And then there was a breakthrough, mercifully, within a few years. And she actually told me something that I think she'd just got to the point, perhaps, of seeing that I was not to be put off. And it was necessary to tell me something. And what she told me was shocking, very disorienting. It toppled me over, really. Her story was that she'd been raped at the age of 15 by a Catholic priest. We were not Catholics in our community. There were very few Catholics there, but the small Catholic community that there was used to hold masses on Sunday morning of a rather informal kind at a doctor's office. The doctor happened to be Catholic. And she went with her Catholic friend, who was the daughter of an Italian immigrant family, to see how Catholics celebrated their religion, very different from ours. Not that we had one particularly. We were not especially observant, but I suppose you would have classified us as generalized Protestants, Anglicans, perhaps. And she went along to this interesting and intriguing ceremony, and Father Francis was the name that she was given for this priest, she told me, took an interest in her and offered to walk her home after the Mass. But he didn't take her home. He dragged her into a garden at one point and pushed her to the ground, and according to her, she was raped by him, and then he disappeared. And thus began, you know, my new understanding, for a while anyway, of how I came about. Hmm. And as I say, it was a great shock to me.
Right.
And then I started setting about finding this priest.
I'm curious about that moment when your mother said this to you and what your immediate and visceral response was in terms of her. That is, I wonder if it had ever dawned on you as even a possibility that what she was going to tell you would be something as traumatic as this. And I guess I'm asking because I also wonder if in the immediate wake of what she told you, to what extent you felt any sense of regret of having, in a sense, drawn from your mother such a deeply painful and traumatic story.
No regret, Greg. Shock and surprise, most of all. And it's important to know the circumstances, too. Initially, this information came from her, not in the spoken word. It's rather peculiar in a way. I was moving house, moving house from Britain to New York, and I had one element of the furnishings, if you like, the accoutrements of my house in England, left in the house just after the international movers had packed up everything and we were going to leave. And I'd been attempting to meet with my mother, and she declined the opportunity that we might have had. And instead, she sent me to this one element that I still had in the house. It was a machine. It was a fax machine, if you remember those. And in the fax, she simply said, you obviously just want a name. It was Father Francis. He was a priest who raped me when I was an innocent schoolgirl. He was moved away after you were when you were born. By his superiors, I think was the phrase she used. I have no idea where. And that was it. So then I had to have the conversation. My wife, I was so stunned by this, I didn't quite know what to do. And I'm the journalist, but it was my wife who said, come on, David, you have to just call her. So I got on the phone, and then I had the longest conversation ever, probably. But I know my roaming charges for that call. I'm very clear about it. It was almost 2 hours on the phone, the two of us. And it was interesting. There was a degree of professional questioning going on. At least, you know, I think I sensed that I must be, of course, very careful and respectful of my mother's feelings as I talked about this. But I also tried to probe as much as I possibly could. And you as an interviewer might resonate with this a little bit. Just to begin the whole thing seemed very difficult. And in the end, all I could actually say was, can you tell me what it was like for you? And that's when it all started. That's when the whole detailed narrative came pouring out. About this walk home from the mass and the rape in the garden. So I don't think I reached a point when I was regretful about having asked her anything. It was a journey that we took together in this phone call, and she told me, I believe, exactly what she wanted to tell me. And for a while, that seemed like a closed book for us. And at least in my phrase at the time, my wife and I talked about it, my late wife, she's no longer with us. My wife talked about it as the afternoon that the dam burst and all the information came rushing out. And for a while, I was content with that.
Right.
And then with time and with natural curiosity, and I think a lot of the journalistic juice coursing through my mind, I began to see that I'd better find out more about this man. Not only for my own personal view, my own personal interest, and my sense of myself, and you know what I might have in common with this individual. All those personal questions that came up. I was confronted here as a journalist with a shocking story, a story of a crime, under all the legislation that applied in both England and Scotland at that time. This was a crime. It was sex with a minor. It was a statutory rape, you would call it in the United States. This, whatever happened to this man? Was he allowed to go to other places? And perhaps, as is very common with cases of this kind, did he offend again? All these things started to come up in my more journalistic mind, and I was determined to track him down then.
Could you just say a quick word about the nature of that pursuit? I mean, obviously we can leave it to our listeners to read about that, but I think it would be interesting just to hear a little bit about the assistance that you received concerning this ultimately fruitless pursuit of more information about this priest who had supposedly done this to your mother. You had the assistance of somebody who has done this kind of investigation many times before.
Indeed. Journalists, as you well know, never do anything alone. There's no such thing as a journalist who single-mindedly and individually uncovers the truth. They always need help. We always need help, and I certainly needed help, and I got it. In one case, Well, the first thing to say, of course, is that the Catholic Church at that time was reeling, and in some ways is still reeling, under the impact of exposés of sexual abuse by priests. And the Catholic Church has now, in the decades since then, has changed its rules, are now very carefully elaborated procedures for what they call the safeguarding of minors and vulnerable adults as well from abuse by priests. But at that time, the exposés were still fresh and raw, and the church's first reaction, as is well known now and well documented, was often to cover up such cases and make the records scrubbed clean, so it wasn't possible to search into individual cases in many occasions. So my assistance came most helpfully from a Roman Catholic priest himself, who was in America, but dealt with dioceses all over the world. His own specialty, if you like, was to cope with, what he called erring priests. And sometimes, just sometimes, he said, priests who offended in this way were open to change, that they could, if they were willing to accept treatment for a compulsion, which in many cases that's what it was, they could be treated and perhaps allowed to continue a life of service, but perhaps not in connection with children at any point. That all that kind of way that the church as an organization decided to try and cope with the problem, and I also got help on the UK side of the border, actually in the UK and Ireland. I had some contacts within the church on both sides of the Irish Sea, in Ireland and in Britain. And also, I have to say, some friends in the law enforcement community in Britain, too. So everything, I was conducting everything in a kind of second-hand way, undercover way, you might call it, because I was afraid of the church reacting to what in our trade we call front door inquiries by slamming the door shut and scrubbing the records inside. That's what I was frightened of. We made some progress, some interesting progress. Some leads came up and we were able to follow them. But as you say, annoyingly for me, no matter how skillful we were as investigators, we ended up with a complete dead end. Mm-hmm. And nobody seemed to fit the bill. Although certain people seemed to fit the bill, certain individual men looked as if they might be the person we were looking for. It turned out, especially when it came to comparing DNA, which was just becoming possible at that stage, the prime suspect, if you like, turned out to be no longer suspect at all because their DNA didn't in any way match mine. Mm.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned the matter of DNA, because that is one intriguing thread through your story and through your book, A Question of Paternity, and that is that this life experience of yours spans a period of time in which certain scientific and technological breakthroughs could radically alter the nature of such an investigation. I mean, that, for instance, if you, as a younger adult, even in your 20s, had decided to seriously pursue this, you would have been pursuing this matter without any possibility whatsoever of some of the tools that are not only available now, but that we almost take for granted now, because they are just so much a part of our culture. But it's so interesting to think about the nature of the search itself and the limited possibilities at the outset versus the possibilities open to you now in terms of what this investigation can be like.
Yes, indeed. The fast-developing modern miracle, I think we need to call it, of DNA matching, and especially the popularized form of it through these genealogy websites like Ancestry.com and MyHeritage.com and several, actually many others. But I ended up having my DNA lodged with something like 12 of these web-based databases. And the algorithm search went on constantly, and my DNA samples were constantly being compared with, in the end, about 11 million people. And very interesting developments came up. All of this, as you say, would have been impossible two decades before, and when I was in my 20s and gung-ho for any kind of research at all, but you know, it's my own fault in many ways. I didn't start the search until it was too late. But by that time also, there came into my possession these new tools that we could employ, and they started giving us whole new lines of inquiry, and I think readers of the book will have to follow the story through to see where that took me. It took me in a totally different direction. Not least of all was the fact that many matches that were coming up with me, people who could possibly be a second cousin or a third cousin, were all in Germany. And that was extremely intriguing to me. I made the investigation, of course, veer off into a wholly new direction.
Right. And without going into any deep detail, I think we'll just say that the possibility was raised that perhaps your mother had befriended a German POW.
Absolutely. There was a prisoner of war camp on the outskirts of our village, and although I was born 3 years after the Second World War, prisoner of war camps in Britain, of which there were something like 1,100 of them dotted around the country, their prisoners were not repatriated to Germany until 1948, 3 years after the war ended, and of course the 1948 was also the year of my birth.
Well, I don't think we're giving away too much to say that that a hard and fast answer to this central question continues to elude you, and one presumes may elude you for all time. And of course, part of your book is about that uncertainty with which you have to live. And it's also a book about, it's the story of your own relationship with your mother, who have passed away many years ago, and trying to come to terms with this secret and this part of who she is. As you describe what it was like when your mother became pregnant with you, you sound very sympathetic, I mean, to what society was like, the culture, which made this, in a sense, such a shameful thing for her. Are you inside as sympathetic as you profess to be as you talk about your mother and why she kept this as guardedly secretive as she did?
Oh, I think it's essential that an understanding of what conditions were like for her is vital to take. One of the things that puzzled me is why she kept it a secret for so long. That was one thing. The second thing was, why should she tell me something that turned out apparently not to be true? The rape story, being raped by a priest. Why could she not tell me the actual story, the real truth, straight on at some point? And I think the answer must lie in the fact that she was deeply traumatized by this experience, so traumatized that a fiction was invented for my arrival, which she then somehow had to perform within that fiction. I think she was under incredible strain for that whole period of her early life. I mean, her firstborn was so early in her life. She was a teenage mother. I think she wasn't fully formed herself in many ways. And this was a cauterizing experience for her, I believe. So she was never, I don't think, going to be easy about this matter. And although she ended up presenting me with a mystery that I found infuriatingly difficult to unravel, I can't really assign blame. I just don't know what it, I can't possibly know how difficult it was for her and why she chose these particular stratagems for dealing with it. The only possible response I can have to the whole matter, now that I've probed it as fully as I can, is the approach of compassion. It's the only possible response.
The book is A Question of Paternity, My Life as an Unaffiliated Reporter, published by Envelope Books, and the author, David Tereshchuk. David Tereshchuk, thank you so much for giving the world this powerful and poignant memoir, and thank you for being my morning show guest today.
Thank you, Greg. It's been good talking with you.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We finish out today's program with an interview from the Morning Show archives, an interview that was recorded and initially broadcast back in the fall of 2020. And I am so grateful to be able to have a few minutes to speak with Sonia Manzano, who is beloved to many for her part of Sesame Street for many years with the beloved character Maria, but also the author of a number of wonderful books, including a memoir, Becoming Maria, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx. Her most recent book, her first book for National Geographic, is called A World Together. And this is a book that the world really needs. And it is a beautiful exploration of just what makes our world so beautiful and rich, and how in our diversity we find layers of beauty that we would otherwise never be able to see. And we have a couple of minutes to speak with Sonia Manzano about what inspired her to write this book, A World Together. Sonia Manzano, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much. My pleasure to talk about the book. I jumped at the chance when National Geographic asked me to write a book about diversity, seeing as a state we find the world in today, and especially our country. I'm especially chagrined of the state of affairs, since I thought that Sesame Street had sort of solved all those problems in 1969 and the result of the civil rights movement and the idealism of President Johnson when he wanted to create the Great Society way back in the 70s. So if there's one thing I've learned, it's that just because you address a problem in one generation doesn't mean it's going to spill over into the coming generation. Mm. So it was time for a good book about sharing all the ways that we are the same, in that we feel sad and we feel happy and we all want shelter and we all feel hungry and we all are satisfied when we eat something good, are all the ways that we're the same part of the human condition. The only ways we're different is culturally, and those are the cultural things you should celebrate.
Mm. So explain to our listeners what they find in the pages of this book, both in your words, your lovingly crafted words, but also in the splendid visuals that are also part of this book.
Yes, Laurie Epstein, the photo editor at National Geographic, did a smashing, wonderful job of showing all kinds of kids in all kinds of situations, I wanted some urban images, and she complied by having that wonderful image of the kids playing by a fire hydrant, because that was kind of my experience as a kid growing up in the Bronx. And I was also interested in not shying away from showing a sad image, and we have a picture of a looks like a soldier kissing his child goodbye, and the words that go with it say, "And when people feel scared, they sometimes forget that deep down we're all the same." Mm. And I suppose I'm reacting to the fact that I see so much anger out there more than I thought people felt, but clearly they do. And that must come out of fear, and we forget that we're the same. And that picture, coupled with those words, might inspire conversations in that direction or not. Or someone will just say, well, that's like just a sad picture and leave it at that. So I hope it is a book that starts when you close the last page.
Hmm. What do you think it is that keeps some people from embracing and celebrating this notion of our diversity? What is it that makes that to some people an idea that they just don't warm up to and maybe even feel even kind of repelled by or afraid of? What are people afraid of when it comes to diversity?
I don't know why people are afraid. I honestly don't, and I was struck by a quote. I want to say it was Carrie Mae Weems, but I don't know if she said that, an African-American artist. If it wasn't her, I apologize, but who said, I look in the mirror, but I don't see. What is so frightening? And those words stay with me. And, you know, I do an animated, a voice on an animated show for Nickelodeon where I play a Mexican grandmother. Now, it's very funny. I enjoy myself because they keep correcting my Puerto Rican Spanish. It's a little different. It's a little different. And the food, you know, I'll have to pronounce foods that begin with the letter X. And I don't know how to pronounce them. So they'll help me with the pronunciation. But that doesn't frighten me that they're different. I enjoy it. It doesn't frighten me when I read Sherman Alexie books and I learn about Native American experience. It's curious. It's different from mine. It's when I read about a poor child on a reservation. I was a poor child in the Bronx, but they're very different experiences. And it just... I'm curious about it, not frightened. Hmm. I don't know why some people find any change in anyone's lifestyle or behavior so frightening. I'm at a loss.
In the last 20 seconds, what did you learn from all of your work on Sesame Street that helped you understand and appreciate diversity?
Humor. Humor will go very, very far. People will laugh at the same things. And I think that's why Sesame Street is such a success worldwide, because people will have a sense of humor and usually find the same things universally humorous.
Funny how laughter opens up the heart. And I love your book, A World Together, published by National Geographic. Sonia Manzano, thank you for giving it to the world.
Thank you so much. Stay well.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I have decided to plan an interview that has absolutely nothing to do with the world of politics. We'll talk about music tomorrow. And it is a conversation with an attorney in Boston by the name of Larry Ruttman, who has somewhat late in life become a huge classical music fan. And he was able to sit down with a number of great musicians who came to Boston and has assembled those interviews together into a lovely book called Intimate Conversations, Face to Face with Matchless Musicians. Our weather forecast calls for cloudy, windy conditions, rain showers possible intermittently all day long with a high of 68 degrees. Cloudy, windy, and rainy overnight, a low of 63. Tomorrow, almost identical to today, cloudy, windy, and rainy, high of 68. Sunshine then on Wednesday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha.